This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. Just a week and a half ago, the burrito chain Chipotle confirmed that its credit and debit card network had been hacked and that customers who'd visited multiple locations may have had their information compromised. That includes Chipotle's in Southwest Florida. Later in the show, we'll find out what you need to do to make sure your account isn't at risk, and we'll talk about ways to prevent losing big at the hands of hackers. But first, Florida lawmakers were back in the state capitol for a busy three-day special session last week. The whirlwind meeting was called for after the regular session ended, with many questions about the state's budget and fears that Governor Rick Scott could take the highly unusual move and veto the entire $80-plus billion needed to fund Florida for the next year. But instead, lawmakers made their way back to Tallahassee to talk budgets, school spending, business incentives, and medical marijuana. Here to talk us through what was signed and what was taken off the table during the three-day special session is reporter Eric Sarkissian, the Tallahassee Bureau Chief with the Naples Daily News and USA Today Network. Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live.
It's great to be back.
Also joining the program is WGCU reporter John Davis to discuss what Southwest Florida can expect after this special session deal. Welcome back to the show, John.
Thanks for having me.
We are talking about the three-day special session of Florida lawmakers that ended Friday. What are your thoughts on how lawmakers did their jobs this year? You can share your thoughts on social media. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. On Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. Or you can call in with your thoughts at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. Eric, with USA Today Network, let's start out with why exactly the special session was even needed. For our listeners who may not be following Florida politics as carefully, can you take us back to the end of 2017 legislative session in May?
Sure. This was actually a really interesting time to be covering state government up in Tallahassee. You had someone like House Speaker Richard Corcoran, who is adamant about not not allowing any funding for Enterprise Florida, the state's economic development partnership, Visit Florida, also going after the traditional education budget, instead giving money to charter schools, a lot of things that had ruffled a lot of feathers and left lawmakers kind of not without much to do when they tried to wrap up last month. Of course, that led a lot of these issues were also things that were important to Governor Scott. I mean, it kind of hit close to home for him. Enterprise Florida helps him create his signature mission of job creation and Visit Florida, which is, of course, tied to Florida because tourism is one of our largest industries. So it was almost like it was a to be continued when they wrapped up on when lawmakers wrapped up on May 8th. There was plenty of contention. It just seemed like everyone kind of wanted to go home, and they knew they were going to be back eventually. So at this point, Governor Scott had finally vetoed parts of the budget, big parts. It was actually almost $12 billion. A good chunk of that was the education budget, known as the FEFP, the Florida Educational Finance Program, which is all sorts of different pots of money from local and state and federal that pay for our kids to go to school. He vetoes that. So that right there, the lawmakers were going to have to address that. And then he also had put in, I think, $409 million in other vetoes that, of course, did not sit well with Senate President Joe Negron, because I at least think a quarter of those vetoes were higher ed projects, which is one of his priorities. And then, of course, Governor Scott also vetoed a part of the budget that had to do with Enterprise Florida and Visit Florida, again, two of his most important facets of state government, because those were the programs that was going to cut Visit Florida spending down from $76 million to $25 million. And it was basically leave him without any incentive fund but that would complement Enterprise Florida. So he wanted a change, and I think lawmakers were willing to do that. And like I said, I just think it was kind of a to be continued. Everyone kind of expected it.
So basically, it was kind of a battle of wills. You have the legislature giving him an $83 billion budget. He didn't like a lot of it, decided to cut it, and then invite everybody back to come to the table.
Yeah, to some degree, I like to consider it almost an extension of the negotiations. This was unusual in that a lot of the times, when you see lawmakers come up here, they want to get finished in that 60-day period that's that they're afforded by the Constitution. But in this case, it was almost as if I think that at least with the Speaker, he wasn't done negotiating, and I don't think the governor was done negotiating either. If you remember. The speaker is known for he likes to play basketball. He's very tough on the court. So this was he's very used to these sometimes contentious negotiations. And the governor, of course, he made his millions by negotiating. He's a businessman. And of course, stuck in the middle of this was the Senate president, who had his priorities as well, that He wanted to get his cross. So it was expected.
So, and they could not settle this during regular session. So they ended up going away and coming back. When they come back for a special session, what does that cost?
I believe it cost taxpayers $72,000 a year, and that is, you know, when they come back, lawmakers are afforded per diem, they're afforded, you know, for travel. Of course, their staff has to be up here, albeit there wasn't the same, you know, army of staff that is here during the regular special session.
So it was $72,000 a day?
Yeah, it was $72,000. That's the total. That's what each day of special session was going to cost taxpayers.
And we had three of those.
Correct.
And John Davis, you've covered the state legislature a lot. I mean, you've talked to me before about some of the past sessions. I mean, and they just end in disaster. I mean, very difficult situations where you end up not having a budget. Everybody just goes home with nothing even agreed upon. How would you compare this year's legislative session to years past as far as the different priorities and people playing that tug of war with the budget?
I think despite the need for the special session to address some of these issues, you know, medical marijuana particularly, as well as education issues, it was kind of cleaner than in recent years past. You may remember, you know, it wasn't that long ago we ended the special session early over a stalemate. So we ended it without even passing a budget. And then that year we ended up with multiple special sessions. So lawmakers were coming back all throughout the summer. And as we'd already discussed, that cost, just to sort of do the general work of the session. But I know a lot of folks were frustrated that year in particular because, you know, constitutionally, the only job that lawmakers have to do during the special session is to pass a budget. And that year it didn't happen until we got into the special session. I'm kind of interested to see what happens with Visit Florida going forward now. I mean, that had to be quite a scare for the folks running things at Visit Florida to see their budget slashed to $25 million. And now having that restored back to $76 million, it'll be interesting to see how things work with Visit Florida going forward, just given a lot of the accusations that they had faced regarding a lack of transparency and not particularly being great stewards of the taxpayer dollars.
Was this all about that Pitbull contract with the rapper? Was that the main – was that just the cherry on the top?
I think that
or
was –
were there other issues?
There were other issues, but the thing with Pitbull was definitely the most in the public eye, I think, just because he is such a more widely known public figure outside of, you know, folks who cover Florida politics or pay attention to Florida politics, and how that all came out in the end with
That's
Richard
definitely
Corcoran
a different demographic.
Filing the lawsuit and then the lawsuit not even being needed because Pitbull just releasing the details of the contract on his Twitter page.
Yeah. Well, we're really reliant on tourism down here in Southwest Florida. Do you know, John, of any local beneficiaries of those dollars in our area? Are we going to see some local people here that are going to be impacted by this coming back to its full budget?
Oh, I can't imagine it wouldn't be. I mean, especially here along the coast. I mean, tourism, that industry is the lifeblood for us. So, I mean, of course, we're going to see a benefit.
Yeah. And that was kind of hand in hand with Enterprise Florida. And Eric Sarkisian, the deal reached Friday. It still cut millions from Enterprise Florida. But then in its place, lawmakers gave Governor Scott his own roughly $85 million to spend on jobs and infrastructure projects. What's the difference there?
The difference is rather than Enterprise Florida, they had cut the legislature had cut 21 different incentive programs that the state had, and it varied from different types of tax incentives to even the Quick Action Closing Fund, which is literally cash that Governor Scott would use, and basically at the last stage of a deal, if he was competing with another state, he could offer X company, you know, so much money from this, you know, from this pot, just to kind of sweeten things and maybe entice them. He's not going to have any of that. The incentive, House Speaker Richard Corcoran referred to those programs as corporate welfare. He says we're basically handing money to corporations. Corporations would basically say we're not going to come to your state unless we get these incentives. He thought that was unfair, and also larger companies were getting these incentives while smaller mom and pop shops weren't getting anything. So pervaded. He felt it created an unfair playing field for some of the smaller companies. So now they have this it's a job training and infrastructure fund that pretty much the way I think of it is if I wanted to move my company to down to Lee County and I needed more runway space, Governor Scott or Enterprise Florida could actually step up and say, well, we'll build that runway for you and we'll give you some job training grants or some job training grants that would happen over at the community college. But versus the previous incentive funds that would just help my company, that runway could help, you know, anyone in Southwest Florida. That job training could help anyone who attends Southwestern State College. It's a program that Speaker Corcoran feels comfortable about because it allows more people to make use of it. What he says is kind of a true use of the way taxpayer dollars should be spent.
Instead of taking the taxpayer dollars and just handing it to a company and saying, here you go, and they can put it into whatever they want, it ends up going into more of a public situation, like building hangar space, building runways, and doing some job training. Is there a way that they're going to be able to track that as far as transparency?
There is. It's going to be monitored by DEO, and they already there's a pretty good program that I think I'm one of the guys that actually will monitor these programs day in and day out. But there's a pretty good program that you can actually see how they're tracking these things. The only problem that I've seen with them in years past is they do have, like, there are certain thresholds that they have to hit. Like, if they're going to bring X number of jobs or X number of revenue or whatnot, sometimes. The state will kind of move those goalposts if a company needs help. So it's kind of – it's unfair. They'll say these are the thresholds they must hit, but then if they're not close to the thresholds, you know, all of a sudden things will get a little bit easier for some – you know, one way or another. So that's one of the things that we'll need to watch out for. But there are ways to watch them. It's just a matter of how honest the state will be with it.
Well, and if you're just tuning in, we're talking about a whirlwind 3-day special session for the Florida State Legislature. What are your thoughts on what they did or did not accomplish? Give us a call and share your thoughts at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. Well, the biggest bone of contention, it seems, between the legislature and the governor was the Visit Florida and the Enterprise Florida. The one thing that a lot of voters and regular people back home were keeping an eye on was the medical marijuana situation. So we're going to switch gears. And that was a big unanswered question back in May. So John Davis, WGCU, give me a little bit of background for those who haven't been following that particular issue. Why weren't lawmakers able to get a bill passed?
There were different points of contention in the regular session. One had to do with whether or not to allow for the smoking of marijuana. And then really the House tended to be in favor of not having a whole lot of steep regulations when it came to this burgeoning new industry, which, you know, could potentially be up to $1 billion a year. And so they kind of didn't want to have these caps on how many dispensaries growers could have. But that was something that the Senate was pretty insistent upon. And then those caps actually did end up in the final measure that did get through in the special session.
Yeah, lawmakers ultimately did reach a deal in medical marijuana. It limits the number of stores companies can have in the state. So Eric, with USA Today Network, what else does this ultimate agreement do?
What it doesn't have, which was another fight between the House and the Senate, was it's not going to allow sales tax. All the items, as far as I know, are going to be tax free. I know that the Senate wanted those items to be subject to whether it be the whatever vehicle you use to ingest the marijuana, and also the drug itself was going to be taxed. The House didn't want that. One thing that they're going to be looking for down the road, John Morgan, obviously, who's been thought of as maybe running for governor, has pledged to sue the state because he believes that people should be able to smoke marijuana. That's one of the things that the legislature agreed on, was that they shouldn't smoke. I think the most thing that they can do is go toward, like, vaping, which is not – you're still inhaling stuff, but it's not really smoking. So he plans to file a lawsuit. That hasn't been done yet. So whether that will develop, that's one of the things that reporters will be looking at.
Yeah, I was wondering, because I know that he threatened it before when they hadn't passed any legislation or when it was originally drafted. But now that they have passed it, he still does plan to sue?
As far as I know, yeah. The last thing that I remember him saying was basically saying that this was actually the amendment that was passed in November 2016 that 72% of Florida voters had approved medical marijuana. The implication was that they were going to be allowed to smoke it. And I think John Morgan, the last quote I said that I saw from him was saying that a judge and jury will understand this issue perfectly. Mm-hmm. So but again, this is still a fairly new issue. So we're yet to see what the next steps are.
So as it stands, the current legislation, the way it went through, it requires the Department of Health to license 10 new growers by October. October. It allows four new growers for every 100,000 patients. It allows more retail to come online as patient numbers grow, and the cap expires in 2020. But as you said, that there is not going to be sales tax on that. Did you hear anything about the new growers being licensed, any preferential treatment going to existing ag?
That's one of the things that I believe that the Senate had wanted was a preference to some existing – well, there's the existing growers and there's also the existing agriculture. I think there's preference to if you are a citrus grower – if you are a citrus a grower or a canner, I keep thinking there's one company out there that I know in particular that had hired a lobbyist to get this in there. But existing citrus members of the citrus industry will actually have at least one of the licenses that I think that they'll issue. Or no, it's two of the licenses. I'm sorry. So that is out there. It's somewhat strange. And from what I heard, that there was a lobbyist out there who had really pushed for this company that's actually based in Brazil. We're still developing that angle. But the citrus angle was rather strange when they had put that in there.
That was a weird little curveball, right? Right at the very end.
Mm-hmm.
So the
mm-hmm.
new law allows for patients to use a variety of ailments, including anything a doctor feels would be treated by using cannabis, to use cannabis pills, oils, edibles, and even vape pens. But again, it bans smoking marijuana. And as you said, Morgan may be pursuing legal action on that. So John Davis with WGCU, city councils and county commissioners in Estero, Sarasota, and other parts of the state have already put in some temporary bans when it comes to medical marijuana businesses. Any idea how this deal in Tallahassee is going to change some of those local laws?
Yeah, a lot of those measures were really proactive. If you look at the Charlotte County commissioners, they actually imposed a 9-month moratorium back in late October. So that was before Florida voters had even gone to the polls to say yes to Amendment 2. And, you know, one of the big concerns you'll hear coming out of their meetings, or at least you did back then, was that this is still illegal federally. So they just feel like there's a lot that's still, you know, unknown regarding, you know, having dispensaries in their towns and in their cities. Also, we've seen in Cape Coral, there was recently a non-voting meeting in late May where they had considered or they talked about imposing a moratorium. Some city council members said that's going to create too much red tape. And again, this was not a non-voting meeting, so nothing's really been decided here. But they really just kind of wanted city planners to at least start looking at zoning issues and about where they would allow or not allow dispensaries. Because, you know, for them, it's not just about whether or not you're for or against medical marijuana. They have to consider what kind of impact a dispensary location is going to have on property values, public welfare, public safety, things along those lines. The Estero Village Council, they put a 1-year moratorium on medical marijuana dispensaries back in December, and the city of Bonita Springs also adopted a 6-month moratorium in January of this year. So, you know, a lot of those moratoriums are, you know, it looks like they're going to be expiring before the end of the year if they haven't already. And it's, you know, really time for city and county planners, if they haven't already, to start looking at what kind of zoning restrictions they're going to put in place.
The zoning and planning. Mm-hmm. Is there anything in the state law, Eric, that has anything to do with local municipalities and their zoning?
Yeah, there's actually the legislation does allow local governments to ban marijuana storefront operations. But if if retail outlets are permitted, cities and counties can impose limits on the number of storefronts, So it kind of creates a weird issue, especially in more populated areas where you have one city next to each other, like in Miami. You know, are some of these pot shops, as they're disparagingly called, going to group in, you know, in one city and then not in the other because they're trying to get business from, you know, from those residents? So that's going to be another thing to watch.
And if there's not going to be any are local municipalities going to be able to do any kind of taxing at a local level? I know you said that there's no state tax, but is it possible for a locality like, for example, the village of Estero to be able to do any kind of localized taxing on that?
I'm actually not sure about that.
Well, that'd be something for them to maybe check out. We've heard a lot about lawmakers, you know, having their tug of war, but they actually made a compromise about Lake Okeechobee. So let's talk about that a little bit. What was agreed to? What was the change in tune that made everybody agree to that one?
So toward the end of – I believe it was week 6 of the legislative session, Governor Scott had asked the legislature to consider a plan to give $200 million to the Herbert Hoover Dike. It surrounds the southern shore of Lake Okeechobee. It was actually one of the first lines of defense against using the Coosahatchee and the St. Lucie Rivers to bleed off the floodwaters. This dike used to be able to hold up a lot of the lake if it flooded. The lake has fallen into disrepair. Governor Scott had spoken with his good friend, President Trump. President Trump had agreed to start, you know, moving toward a project to fix that dike, which is a federal – it's a federal project, if the state had put in $200 million. Governor Scott asked the legislature. The legislature basically flatly ignores them. Obviously, at the time, Senate President Negron wanted that reservoir built that was also going to help alleviate use of the two rivers. And Speaker Corcoran didn't even really address it as far as I can remember. This was kind of one of those shocks to that we wake up a Friday morning, and I mean, I think everyone was blown away. But you know, we have House Speaker Richard Corcoran saying, "Hey, we're going to do $50 million for to get the dike project going to start, you know, helping the federal government repair this dike." I think that helped sweeten the deal for Governor Scott to go through with you know, a lot of the not getting exactly what he wanted out of everything. I think that although he did get the $76 million for Visit Florida, which is still facing some pretty stiff you know, regulations in terms of transparency. But it helps sweeten the deal quite a bit, and it also it kind of signaled that this budding relationship between the governor and Speaker Corcoran that definitely wasn't there during May, April, and March.
So what did they end up doing then at the end of the day with Lake O? They ended up using some state lands to build this reservoir?
That's right.
Yeah, that's the plan anyway?
Yeah, it's part of a many year plan. They're going to build a reservoir just south of Lake Okeechobee. A lot of it is going to be state land. A lot of it's currently used by it's a company that employs prisoners named Pride that they were actually using the land to farm. The state's actually going to take those folks. It was a leased land. They're going to take those folks off that land and use a lot of that to build this reservoir that's going to help alleviate you know, any of the floodwaters from going into the Caloosahatchee and the St. Lucie Rivers. And speaking of tourism, you know, there's nothing worse than that was destroying the estuaries along the Gulf Coast than all that fresh water that was, you know, flushing out a lot of the wildlife and whatnot. So that project was $300 million, and there's going to be an option to bond in the future. So, but that project, with Governor Scott's approval, which it already has, it should start rolling sometime later this year.
And John Davis with WGCU, what kind of agreement, what does this kind of agreement mean for like South Florida's communities like ours? I mean, we're not going to have the guacamole, goop, algae situation from all of that runoff water in the future. I mean, is that... It's a little bit down the road. They still have to build all this.
Sure, yeah. It would still have to be built, of course. And yeah, that's the general idea. I mean, of course, we'll have to wait and see. That's generally the idea, is that we've always had this sort of – I don't want to call it a battle, but there's been some contention between folks in the Glades area who were very much sort of against the idea of building this reservoir and, you know, sort of balancing their interests versus those of coastal communities like ours and, you know, folks, you know, at the other end of the St. Lucie River as well, where, you know, they really experience some of that bad toxic algae bloom. And it's just, you know, it doesn't look good. It's bad for the environment. It's bad for tourism. So I think this is something that folks can embrace and just also want to do. Mention the building of the reservoir south of Lake Okeechobee, that bill also included some funding for economic incentives in Glades County. So they did really try to compromise there and do a little something for everybody.
And the people in the Glades County, the organizations that were kind of lobbying fervently against this in the very beginning, they ended up coming out in the end saying that they were happy with this kind of a compromise.
I believe so. I haven't heard a lot of negativity from that.
I've heard everybody seem to be – have you heard anybody negative, Eric?
No, the biggest concern that they had was that obviously it was going to be – that the state was going to buy land from the sugar industry, and that was also – that also equated to that people were going to be losing jobs because the sugar industry is – it's a big employer down there, and by taking away that land, you're taking away jobs. So that ruffled a lot of feathers, but I think that Senate President Joe Negron actually came back and said, well, let's just use state land, and it was a project I think everyone could get behind. And in his own words, you know, there's no project that's a good project. We've been debating about this for decades. You know, this was the one that he knew the most, that we've debated the most. Let's go ahead and go with it and see if it flies.
Yeah, it's just hard to get everybody at the same table to agree on anything. But everybody wants the end goal to be that the Everglades be fine. So
exactly.
It's a tough one. So let's shift gears a little bit here to education. And you mentioned earlier, Eric, about K-12 education funding. It was a big issue that drew lawmakers back to Tallahassee. But what was the situation that made them have to go back? It was a potential veto?
The governor had veto. He said he was going to veto the state's education budget. At that point, it was $11.4 billion. But to put it in perspective for anyone, or how I understand it, is it was an increase of $24.49 per student, which is much lower than what the Senate wanted and what Governor Scott wanted. I think both of them wanted to see I think at one point the Senate was at somewhere around like $7,423 per student, and I think right now it was about $200 leap. The speaker didn't want to go along with that. The problem with the way the education budget is set up in the state is that districts that might be seeing decreased enrollment will receive the same amount of money as districts that are booming. So it's kind of uneven. So he had concerns about the way that some districts were performing. He's a big proponent of school choice. He's a big proponent of charter schools. So he had his bill, Schools of Hope, which was going to give – at the end of the day, it was going to give about $160 million to these charter schools so that they can expand in these struggling districts. But that was not going over well with the school districts. That was not going over well with Governor Scott. Governor Scott's office got thousands of emails and phone calls about how much of a problem this was. So they came back and this is one of the few things the House and Senate kind of agreed on when they first walked in, was giving $250 million additional to that $11.4 billion, which meant that rather than the $24.49 per student, it was going to be about $100 per student, which was a little bit of an easier pill to swallow. We still had the Florida Education Association that was concerned, and also some districts were concerned. I know Miami-Dade was worried that it was still not enough money, but it was better than what it was with what they signed off on in May.
So they were going to increase their spending on students by $24 and change per year, and then
it was a measly increase. There was a lot of people say, but they've since upped that to about $100.
But $100 a year, how does that compare with previous increases in spending for education? I mean, do they usually have an increase every year?
They do, and usually, I mean, I think last year it went up by about $100. Just around $200, I think. We did have an incline over the past 5 or 6 years. We saw a drop, of course, when the Great Recession hit with the mortgage crisis. Florida was ground zero for that, so we saw a drop in education spending. Slowly and gently, we started growing that back. And of course, you'll hear from Governor Scott's camp that will say we've had record amount for education funding, record amount, and it kept on growing up to by $200 per student every year. But then this $24 per student was kind of a shock, especially with the way that the economy is going. Florida's still getting out of that hole from the recession, but we are definitely doing better every year. So,
yeah. Well, the regular session ended with concerns about backroom deals setting final policy, despite weeks of hammering out the details in committees and on the floor of the House and Senate. And then they leave regular session. They have some meetings. A few people have a few meetings, and then they all go back for 3 days. How is that spinning in the public eye, Eric?
As of right now, the problem with the backroom deals, it wasn't just about the budget deals that were going down. It was the fact that these backroom deals, as they're calling them, had to deal with a lot of policy issues. A lot of this, the education bill that was a part of the Schools of Hope, the charter school bill that was a priority of the speaker, parts of that were vetted and debated in public, but the actual bill that they put together, which again included policy, was not. It was kind of hammered out together, behind closed doors. I know that people directly responsible or directly affected by those, especially in public schools, are concerned that was a backroom deal. There's worry there, but outside of that, I haven't heard too much. It's just kind of one of those things that once you get outside of Tallahassee, people tend to not really pay attention to that much. One thing that was actually kind of interesting was the deal that they had come to, whether it was the deal that that Governor Scott and Speaker Corcoran and Senate President Joe Negron had announced that Friday, when the governor was going to say he was going to veto parts of the budget, that was essentially kind of brokered, behind closed doors. So it kind of, and if you don't remember, Governor Scott was actually one of the people who were flying around the state saying that this was a backroom deal. This was back in May, saying that the legislature had crafted this backroom deal this budget, and had these concerns. So, but then he kind of goes off and starts doing it on his own. So there's something to be said there, on where they plan to go, at least with next year, and how much of an appetite at least a lot of the folks in Tallahassee have.
And John, did you hear much about pushback as far as backroom deals or any legislators complaining about not being included in some of those deals?
I mean, even as recently as last week before the session started, Lee County School District Superintendent Gregory Adkins, had held his own press conference. Like the superintendent in Miami, like our other guest had mentioned, was against the education bill, before the special session came out. And that was one of the criticisms, was about the backroom deals. Interesting position that lawmakers are in, though, because you can – hammer these things out sort of ahead of time, and then when you bring everybody together, you have something to bring to the table. Or if you don't do that, as we discussed before, we're spending $72,000 a day on these special sessions. So you're kind of weighing that transparency versus cost.
Transparent. I wonder if they could, release information about what they have discussed. Or do sunshine laws apply to these kinds of meetings?
They actually should. I mean, technically, it depends on how many lawmakers are actually getting together to discuss anything. I think any knee-jerk reaction to any reporter up in Tallahassee in the Capitol, if they see two lawmakers talking about the budget, two or three lawmakers, we're going to do the best we can to push for questions and ask, that we observe them doing that. They can give us their, the recount of what had happened, but more often than not, I know that as a reporter, I'm skeptical of what report that they'll tell me. I'd rather hear it for myself and hear the back and forth. I mean, even before they were it kind of gotten to this point with the ideas of the backroom deals, when they were doing the conferences, when the Senate and the House would get together and say what projects they were agreeing to and what projects they weren't, it all kind of seemed choreographed. So it definitely left me scratching my head when I first started covering the state government about 4 years ago.
Yeah. Well, we're going to have to leave it there for now, but I want to thank our guest, Eric Sarkisian with the USA Today Network. Thanks so much for joining us from Tallahassee.
Thank you so much.
And John Davis with WGCU News. Thank you for the local insight. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Coming up in just the last month, gas stations and restaurants in South Florida were targets for cybercrime, putting your credit card data and personal info in jeopardy. So what should you do if your data is part of a hack? We'll ask experts from a local bank and the Charlotte County Sheriff's Office to find out. I'm Julie Glenn, and this is Gulf Coast Live. Stay with us.
I'm in love with you. I ain't lying when I tell you I want to be your fool. I know you got a lot of man folks running after you, but none of them are going to treat you as good as I plan to do. Break me off a piece of that pork chop, baby. Break me off a piece of that meat. Break me off a piece of